It's possible we take environmental laws for granted. Think about it. The Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, those have all been on the books for nearly half a century. Law and the environment are constant companions in our time. Witness the lawsuits on behalf of children filed to force governments to take action to curb climate change. Our guest this hour makes her living in environmental law and has a perspective to offer on legal action regarding the environment. Mary Christina Wood is the Philip H. Knight Professor of Law and the faculty director, the founding director, in fact, of the school's Environmental and Natural Resources Law Center. She teaches property law, natural resources law, public trust law, and federal Indian law, and has taught public lands law, wildlife law, and hazardous waste law as well. So pretty much an environmental cornucopia there for Mary Christina Wood. Thanks for joining us today, Mary.
Thank you so much.
Just broadly, is there ever a dull moment in environmental and natural resources law?
No, there's never a dull moment. Everything I teach makes the headlines just about every day. The situation with our planet and our ecology is just kind of spiraling closer and closer to all-out catastrophe, and so the students in my classes perk up, listen up, they know this affects their lives.
Is that a big motivator for a lot of the students? Have they gotten into that because they share that sense of catastrophe?
Well, it is a motivator. I mean, one has to be careful because it can easily be so depressing that it has the opposite effect. But students feel empowered, and they go out there and they make change, and they have a vision, and we try to help them implement it.
How long have law schools been teaching the realm of environmental law? I remember somebody going into it about 25 years ago, but it seems like it was even active before that.
Well, it really was. The statutes that are thought of as environmental law, the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act and so forth, those were passed in the early 70s. So law schools have been teaching it for a very long time. The problem is that for decades, law schools taught just statutory law, and we've kind of boxed ourselves in that that realm because there's some real dysfunction with statutory law. And so now we're trying to teach other approaches as well.
Dysfunction like what?
With statutory law, there's a lot of discretion given to federal agencies and state agencies to actually allow the very damage that the statutes were designed to prevent. So, for example, the Clean Air Act allows pollution to the air. The Clean Water Act allows pollution to the water. And what happened over time was agencies became very captive to the industries that they were supposed to be regulating. And over years and years, issuing permits became the norm, and drawing the line against damage was really an exception. And so now we sit here on the threshold of a new administration that is ready to take all of that environmental authority that we've given the executive and use it against against the environment.
Which is something I think it might be hard to get across to people who don't practice law or teach law, that the fact that a law can mean a very different thing depending on who's in charge of executing the law.
Well, that's right. The statutes were all very well-intentioned, but they gave way too much discretion to these agencies, like the Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Forest Service and so forth. And it was always presumed that these agencies would act for the public and in favor of the public interest. But over time, over decades, industries like the fossil fuel industry applied so much pressure on the agencies to permit damage that really across the board, state and federal agencies have a problem with being politicized and often turning against the very public that they're supposed to protect.
How, for example, do you think we can curb regulatory capture? I mean, if in fact the people who are from the industries that are being regulated end up going through the revolving door and ending up in the regulatory bodies, how do you prevent those regulatory bodies from giving wink, wink, nudge, nudge, handshake sorts of deals to their buddies?
Yeah, you really have to go outside the system of statutory law to have any sort of constraints on that system itself. If you stay within the box of statutory law, the progress is way too incremental and it doesn't catch up with the damage that the industry is inflicting. And so one thing Americans really have to realize is that we have three branches of government. We have since the beginning of this nation, and the third branch of government, which would be the judiciary, was constituted to protect the fundamental rights of Americans. And now our ecology is so much at the brink of collapse that it is impairing, the situation is threatening the fundamental rights of Americans. And so increasingly now, the American people have to understand that judicial enforcement against agencies may be necessary to curb what could otherwise easily turn into a tyrannical type of situation.
You're comfortable using that term, brink of collapse?
Brink of collapse, yes, because we're on the threshold of irreversible climate tipping points. I mean, there are thresholds in nature that create positive feedbacks that if we go beyond those, nature's own feedback processes will kick in and create an out-of-control situation. Like, for example, the northern latitudes have permafrost that is melting already. If that permafrost really gets going in the melt, it would release huge amounts of carbon dioxide and methane, which would create what some scientists and others call an atmospheric tsunami type of situation, which would make our own emissions seem insignificant. So we can't allow the planet to be pushed so far as to trigger those feedback loops. But we are really on the brink now.
Mary Christina Wood is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, environmental lawyer and environmental law expert, teaches at the University of Oregon Law School, and is the faculty director of the Environmental and Natural Resources Law Center. What things would you like to see done through law in terms of protecting the environment? Let's hear your thoughts on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So there's been some action lately on these Children's Trust lawsuits, particularly in Oregon's version of the lawsuit. What's up now there?
So that's an example of going to the courts to enforce fundamental rights. So our Children's Trust, which is a nonprofit organization based in Eugene, actually brought several lawsuits, lawsuits across the country and also one in federal court that turned to the public trust doctrine. And the one in federal court also turns to the U.S. Constitution to provide relief against a fossil fuel policy that is driving our climate towards these irreversible tipping points. So the big case that is sitting here in the Federal District Court of Oregon in Eugene, Oregon, is called Giuliani versus Obama. It was a suit brought on behalf of 21 youth from across the country against many agencies in the Obama administration and President Obama himself, challenging the entire fossil fuel policy of the United States. And that is a huge transformative lawsuit. It is the kind of lawsuits that I believe is needed at this time because it goes from outside the statutory box to try to rein in agencies and turn the fossil fuel policy around that has been so devastating.
I was going to ask you about that. So it is not a statutory thing. You're really going to what is expected to be a basic sort of deal between government and its people.
Yeah, the litigators and the youth plaintiffs are challenging the fundamental duty of government. They're saying that government has, by perpetuating the fossil fuel policy, has endangered the future of these children, and these children have fundamental rights under the U.S. Constitution and the public trust to a safe and balanced climate system, and that is so key to their future and fundamental rights. It should be enforced by a court. So it is exactly the kind of lawsuit that comes at the problem from outside this very narrow statutory box, which gives enormous discretion to these federal agencies.
So for those of us still trying to grasp public trust doctrine, can you give an example of a way it's been used not related to the atmosphere?
Sure. One of the foundational public trust cases was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court way back in 1892. And there, the Illinois legislature had just given away the shoreline of Lake Michigan to a private railroad company, just given it away. And the people needed that shoreline for fishing and navigation and their commerce. It was a very essential resource for society, and the legislature just gave it away. And so the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. These essential resources, like the shoreline, are held in trust for the people, and that government is a trustee and has certain obligations because of that that can't be abdicated. In other words, it's part of the sovereignty of government, and no matter if you're president or have a lot of power in government, you are a trustee and cannot abdicate that responsibility to the people. And so that shoreline actually, the conveyance was revoked and went back to the people. So this lawsuit in the climate context is analogous, because basically what the youth are saying is that the Environmental Protection Agency and the federal agencies are essentially giving away the atmosphere, giving away the climate system to be polluted by the fossil fuel companies. And doing so will impair their survival later on in this century. So it is absolutely crucial to their fundamental rights to have a stable atmosphere, and the public trust should protect it as an obligation of government.
Environmental law, the topic here on the Jefferson Exchange. Mary Christina Wood from the University of Oregon Law School, our guest. You can join us at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Anne and Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange.
Thank you. The way I see it, there are two things that are threatening the biosphere that allows human life to exist. And one of them is human greed, and the other one is overpopulation. And yet, I don't know of a single politician in the United States who has said anything about human overpopulation. I mean, I remember back in the 70s where Bob Packwood, who was running for the Senate at the time, came out with a proposal to limit deductions on income tax to two children. So anyway, I know that you're talking about this case against the fossil fuel industries, but that's only one of the things that is threatening our survival, and I'd like to hear your views on this.
All Thank right, you. Thanks, Anne. Appreciate that. Your thoughts, Mary Christina?
Yeah, Anne talked about greed and overpopulation, and that she's absolutely right that there are these systemic problems we have in our society, these global problems that have to be identified and addressed. Some are more easily addressed through the legal system than others. Consumption is really the combination of greed and overpopulation. And the consumption in this country is, of course, much greater than most other countries in the world. And so consumption and waste and all of those problems are part of the culture of American society. Those absolutely have to be addressed. From the legal perspective, consumption can be addressed, actually, through measures, through multiple policy measures, but it also has to bore down to the cultural premise that we're just allowing all of this waste and consumption without question.
We have an email question from Bruce Notown Given. He wants to ask, how do we protect public lands from being sold off?
The public trust doctrine that I mentioned applies to any essential resources and also resources that are owned by the public. And so the Supreme Court of the United States has already declared that public lands are in public trust. The public trust doctrine would seem to be the approach legally to prevent public lands from being sold off. The government is a trustee for us, for the people, not for the fossil fuel companies. And so, conceivably, every decision it makes on public lands should be subject to the public trust inquiry, which is the decision being made to promote the public interest, and would it have any substantial impairment to the resources remaining? I think if you were to examine a lot of public lands policy through this public trust lens, you would find that many of the decisions made to benefit private industry were invalid. So again, the public trust is probably this out-of-the-box approach that offers a fresh perspective, whereas the statutes don't offer that much. Congress can change those.
And the climate change lawsuits go a little further outside the box by being filed in the name of children. Why that particular move?
The youth have the most to lose in our climate crisis because they will live, their life expectancies go towards the end of the century. And the climate crisis threatens the very conditions that they need for their survival and welfare. They're looking at a future that is absolutely terrifying. And those are words that even President Obama used with respect to the climate crisis. So youth have the rights that are the most at stake just by virtue of their lifespans. And I should mention, too, that they are not only asserting rights under the public trust, but our Children's Trust, which is the organization bringing these lawsuits, also asserted constitutional rights under the Due Process Clause of the U.S. Constitution. And those were found by the Federal District Court of Oregon, along with the public trust, to be fundamental rights that should protect the climate system that these children need for their survival.
Mary Christina Wood, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, will take a few more minutes with her talking about environmental law. She is the faculty director of the Environmental and Natural Resources Law Center at the University of Oregon Law School. And you can join this conversation, ask your questions about environmental law and how it is applied. 800-838-3760 to get in by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. I noticed the state of Washington also is a separate suit in that state. Well, let me come back, too, because you mentioned this is the case in Oregon is Juliana versus Obama. It was Juliana versus Kitzhaber, then Juliana versus Brown. Is the state suit no longer there, and has it just reverted to a federal suit, or these different actions?
These are different actions. So back in 2011, our Children's Trust filed state actions in court or petitions to agencies in every single state in the country. So this was a broad-scale effort to force government to bring carbon dioxide emissions down in every jurisdiction. So there's state cases and petitions that were filed in every state. There is a state case in Oregon, and there's also one in Washington. There's the one I was talking about is a separate case filed against the federal government, but it happened to be filed here in the Federal District Court of Oregon. So the state of Oregon actually has two cases. One is a state case against the governor, and one is a federal case against the Obama administration that will soon be the Trump administration.
All right. Another question here from Pat in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Mary Christina Wood.
Good morning. I had a couple of questions concerning the Dakota Access Pipeline. The first one being, what is kind of the legal perspective on the rights that the people there have to protect their land? And also, if you can help us understand why President Obama hasn't acted, is there some kind of legal mechanism that he could be using but he isn't? Or what's the situation there from your perspective?
All right, thanks for the question, Pat.
Yeah, the Dakota Access Pipeline is one of those huge projects that requires multiple permits, probably a dozen between federal and state agencies. And that all the permits were granted, which is so typical in environmental law. Permits are given out, you know, very readily by agencies. But it's come down to one last permit that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is holding on to. And the Corps of Engineers has not yet granted that one last permit. So the people who are at Standing Rock right now are occupying that land and protesting that basically that one last permit, if you want to put it in a legal sense. President Obama certainly has the authority to not issue the permit. For some reason, he has not come forth with that. The Corps of Engineers, I will point out, did issue a permit denial for a project at Cherry Point, Washington, which would have destroyed the Lummi Nation's fishing rights. That was a huge coal terminal proposed up in Washington, and the Obama administration's Corps of Engineers did deny a permit for that. Why the Obama administration has not come out forcefully against the Dakota Pipeline, I think because for most of its years in office, That administration was allowing permits. That administration was pushing projects, opening federal lands for mining and drilling, opening offshore areas for offshore drilling. President Obama was, in fact, a huge proponent of natural gas, oil, and coal development until the last couple years in his administration, where he kind of turned, went to Alaska, saw the damage, and started realizing how terrifying global warming was.
Now, the Standing Rock Sioux are suing the Army Corps of Engineers. That case was filed in August. Any progress on that you're aware of?
Not really. They're suing just under standard environmental law statutory grounds. And so these measures, again, are totally within the statutes. There are other approaches. There's the public trust, which certainly would come to bear here because we're talking about a waterway. But that has not been subject to any suit filed that I'm aware of. There's also an Indian trust doctrine, which is sort of parallel, which is a special trust obligation for tribes and their property rights, but that I don't think has been part of the legal challenge either.
Very quickly here, because we're under a minute now, that the pipeline builders and their supporters make the claim that people file suits under environmental law, making it hard to get infrastructure projects built on a timely basis. George Will made the same claim recently. Is that fair?
Well, no, it's not fair, because overall, the fossil fuel industry is destroying the landscape with permits. Of course, it takes a while to get permits, but overall, permits have been granted.
All right. Mary Christina Wood, legal expert on environmental law, teaches at the Environmental and Natural Resources Law Center, for which she's the faculty director at the University of Oregon Law School. Thanks so much for joining us today for a perusal of environmental law.
Thank you.
All right. Take it easy.